Hello, everyone, and welcome to the inaugural episode of A Recipe for Murder, a true crime and baking podcast. We're really glad that you're here. I'm Jackson.
I'm G.
Today, we'll be telling you about the murder of Ginny Lynn, as well as baking some lemon cookies.
Yeah, so I'm making some lemon thyme icebox cookies. They are, I just found the recipe online. It's technically a spring cookie, even though we're recording this in January.
Lemon what is an icebox cookie?
I don't know, actually. I think they're like cookies that are like strips. So they're not like a circle or a square. They're like a strip of cookie.
Okay.
So I'll be making those. So I got this recipe off of tasteofhome.com. It's really simple, only 8 ingredients. Butter, sugar, thyme, lemon zest, egg yolk, flour, baking powder, and salt. Really easy stuff to find. I've already started making the cookies. They're currently chilling. Basically, I combined the butter, sugar, thyme, lemon zest, and like beat it until it was soft. Then I added the egg yolk, and then I mixed in the dry ingredients. I put it into a roll, and I put it in the fridge, and that's where it is currently. In just a few minutes, I'm gonna start baking it. I picked this recipe because Ginny Lynn, when I was looking at it a little bit, obviously you did more research. When I was looking at it, I noticed that she seemed like a very bright student. She was very well-rounded. She was a dancer, she played tennis, she was really great in school, and obviously, not to spoil much, but she was murdered very young. So I wanted to pick a recipe that seemed like very bright, and when I think of lemon and thyme, which are very bright flavors, especially together, they make for a very bright and springy flavor.
All right, and so I'm going to be getting into the actual murder and the investigation of Ginny Lynn. So our story starts on May 27th, 1994. Ginny Lynn was a 14-year-old girl living in Alameda County in California. And one day, after school, she went home. Her father was working that day, and he got off work around 6 o'clock and went to the metro station. And from there, he went to his usual station, and he got there at 6:45. When he was on the metro, he called the house, but Ginny didn't pick up. Now, he kind of thought, oh, maybe she's doing chores, maybe she's out with the dog. No, it wasn't unusual. He didn't think anything of it. He gets home around 7 o'clock, and he notices that Ginny wasn't there. When he opened the door, called out her name, she didn't respond. So he thinks, oh, maybe she's outside. And so he walks into the house, and the first thing he realizes is that the TV's on, and there's a show playing, and there's an uneaten microwavable dinner on the dinner table. He's like, I don't know why anyone would leave this here. So he continues to walk around the house. He goes outside, and so basically the house, to get to the back porch, back patio area, there's a sliding glass door. And so he opens it, and he's like, why is this? He notices that he kind of thinks like, oh, it's unlocked, which is very unusual, because May Lynn, his mother, basically every time I go out to work every single morning, she would check to make sure that all the windows were locked, all the doors were locked, you know, the stove was off, all these kind of normal things. So he thinks, oh, well, maybe Jenny's outside with the dog, and so it's unlocked. But he goes out there, and there's a dog, but there's no Ginny. So he's very perplexed by this, because I always tell Ginny, you know, be safe, lock the door if you're not going to be outside. He continues walking around downstairs, you know, no sign of anybody, even though he's calling out her name, he can't find her. And then he starts to walk up to the second floor, kind of with this growing sense of dread. And he walks around there for a bit, he can't find her, until he goes into his bedroom and notices that the ensuite bathroom to the room was shut. But he has this horrible feeling because it is never shut. Unless someone's in the bathroom, the door stays open, so why would it be open? Because Ginny has her own bathroom, there's really no need for her to be in this room. And so he goes over to the door and he kind of slowly opens it, very, very, the bad sense. And to his horror, he finds Ginny face down in a pool of blood. And she's naked, and her arms have been bound behind her back with duct tape. and her clothes, he realizes, have been cut off. So he's like horrified. He can't even like breathe for a minute. Oh, and then God. He rolls over. Yeah, I know. It's a really gruesome murder. It's very scary. He rolls her over and he finds puncture wounds. And he knows that Janie was dead like immediately. So obviously the first thing he does is call 911. Mm-hmm. To do CPR. And he's kind of telling them, you know, yo, like, she's dead. Like, so he does it for a bit, but there's no point. She died. And this is after a few minutes, you know, the police and police are just pulling up. So he gets off the phone, 911, and he calls Maylin's mom, or calls Maylin, Janie's mom. It's like, can you even imagine calling somebody and being like, our daughter was murdered? Like, that's I don't know how you could ever get those words out. I mean, yeah. That's
like the most heartbreaking thing a parent would have to go through, like having to like call their spouse and say like, hey,
it's just
our kid's dead.
So sad. So basically, after Aylin, she leaves work immediately, runs down to her car and drives home, kind of just thinking, I can't believe this. It's not really happening. Like, I can't believe it. And then she gets to the house. She sees Denny, and then it's like, kind of like it all just like body for her. And so when the cops arrived, the first thing they did, of course, was to sweep the house. And I'd like to point out this house is literally in the middle of suburbia, and like, it's kind of confusing. It's like in the middle of the Hollywood Hills, and this one neighborhood is literally, it's seriously like one street. All these like houses, like the same model houses down the street. And so it's like in the middle of nowhere, and this is just like this horrific crime that was like completely, like, no one realized this would happen. So they get all these cops here because it's like such a big deal in this little neighborhood. All these cops come because it's horrible. And so the cops, they kind of get this idea of what happened essentially. So they find footprints, like the mark from shoes on the deck and backyard, and they kind of determine there's not a full print, but I can't tell what size it is. They think it's around the 9 to 11 size range. And they think it's a Gorilla work boot or some kind of similar brand. And so they start kind of like piecing together this story, what happened. And so they first think that the killer tried to unlock the sliding glass floor, actually on the second floor, not the one that John Lynn went out of. They find these like pry marks that they think came from a flat tip screwdriver, but they never found the weapon that was used to do it. And so this was unsuccessful to break into the house. And so they then think that the killer was downstairs, and then they found a smashed dining room window. And the police believe that the killer attempted to cover it up. And so basically, in the Lynn house, the curtains they have, it's like, basically the curtains are pulled together in the middle, which creates kind of like a bow almost, like a triangle above and then a triangle below. They meet at the tip. And so this one, when the bow been pulled almost all the way down, which made the curtain expand where the glass was broken, just because every other window was normal. I think that the killer closed it so that Jenny wouldn't notice it. There were glass shards that had been moved, and the window, there was a sizable hole, so they think that an adult male could fit through it, which is kind of odd because if you take a look at the photos, like there's like, it's a very small hole. Like I would have thought that no one could fit through that, but the police thought otherwise. And there are shards in the hole, so it's like if you crawled or slid through it, I feel like you would have gotten cut, but there was no like evidence on that. And so they think that the killer broke in before Jenny got home, so that way he could cover up and hide hid in the house. I think that after he murdered Jenny, he unlocked the sliding glass door that John Lynn found, and then he left. There's no evidence of thievery, so the person's planned on killing somebody. I think what's key, because when I first heard this, I thought that she had been like sexually assaulted or raped or something, yeah, because she was naked. But they did do a sexual assault test, and they found no evidence of anything like that. Really odd, because why take her clothes off, and also like why kill her then? This is a 14-year-old girl, like, straight-A student. And, like, why?
I'm really confused about the motive here. Like, why do they care?
Just, I don't understand it. Like, seriously, I was awake all night. And like I said, she was a straight-A student. She was supposed to be the class valedictorian. Everyone loved her. She was like a prodigy at piano and viola. She ran on the school cross country team. She danced. She played tennis. Like, she was like just like really well-rounded kid. Everyone liked.
Could it have been that maybe someone was like envious of her and like was like connected to someone and killed
her? You might think that. But actually the police, they kind of thought that it was an adult man just because it was like,
yeah,
no man of a struggle. Like, he was just so easily able to overpower her. And I guess it could have potentially been like parents of another classmate, but I kind of think that's kind of a bit of a stretch in motive. That's kind of unlikely.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is a possible, like, I haven't been able to work out the motive.
Yeah, it is kind of a stretch, but it's...
It's an option we got to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. And so, basically, over the next, like, couple of days, the police they canvassed the neighborhood, and they asked all these neighbors, hey, have you seen anything? Did you see some stranger in the neighborhood? Like, were you here when the murder happened? Because, reminder, this murder was, I think it was around 6. It was before I got home at 7. So this murder was literally in broad daylight. Like, this is, like, not some, like, sneak into the house in the middle of the night and murder her. It's, like... They had been hiding for, you know, who knows how long before, like, she was home.
Yeah.
And so, basically, when they were talking to the neighbors, they did get a few tips. None of them were incredibly helpful. One neighbor said he saw a man that he'd never seen before in the neighborhood leaving the neighborhood, like, walking away. And he was carrying a blue duffel bag. And he was, like, kind of, like, walking through the baseball field they had there. And he had something covering his head, like a hood or some kind of hat. And he was... eyes to the ground, avoiding eye contact to everybody. Another person saw a motorcyclist. One person saw a sister. And the other heard a dog barking loudly around 3 p.m. But that conflicts with the timeline that police have created. Mm-hmm. The killer would have already been in the house because Ginny got out of school at 2:25 that day. And she got home around 2:45 on the bus. The dog was barking at 3. Then... the killer would have had to broke in after Jenny was home. And in that case, well, you know, wouldn't she have heard it? Wouldn't she have run or something? So I don't really think that relates to this too much. I mean, dogs bark is what they do. However, an option that police basically thought of was potentially someone was coming around the Glenn home for a long period of time, getting the dog comfortable and kind of canvassing and figuring out what the home looked like in order to break in. So perhaps the dog adjusted to the stranger, or perhaps like it didn't suspect anything of them. But this theory kind of make sense, but to me, you know, I'll bring, like, even when I get home, my dog start barking, and I've been living with him for like 10 years, so I don't really think this theory is like completely like airtight. Okay. And so basically, when Jenny got home, she walked in at 2:45, and she called a friend, and this call was about an hour long. You know, it was just a regular conversation. The friend didn't pick up any kind of nervousness or tension from Jenny. It was just a regular conversation. She was on the phone all the time as a kid. Mm-hmm. And in fact, after she got off around 4:45, she calls another friend, and typically this call like ends really abruptly. Friend doesn't know why, and so she thought that Jenny's parents were home. Maybe she's getting off. She wasn't sure, but remember, John Lynn doesn't get home till 7, and so she calls back. But Jenny does pick up, and they were on the phone till 5:30. And once again, just like a regular conversation, like no kind of suspicious activity going on. And Jenny's into the phone. And it ended around 5:30. And basically, that was because Jenny said that she needed to do chores, needed to do some things around the house before her parents came home. And this was the last time anybody spoke to Jenny. Huh. And so, the police, initially, they wanted to talk to the family because they were like, we really don't suspect you, but we need to, like, clear you as potential suspects. So, yep. Jenny had an older sister, Rhoda, but she was in college at the time, and she was an hour away, so she wasn't really ever involved. And she did pass a polygraph confirming this. Next, the mom, Maylin, she told police that everything was locked and that she checked it that morning. And she called Jenny at 4:30, but went to the answering machine. She also passed a polygraph. And then the dad, John, he left with Jenny at 7:35 in the morning and dropped Jenny off at school. He then went to the Bay Area Rapid Transit, which is called BART, which is kind of a funny name. And so then he went to San Francisco for work. Like I said, he went home, he found Jenny, and he also passed a polygraph. So he wasn't a suspect to police because he's the one that found the body. However, he did mention something that I think is, like, crucial, which I honestly, in my opinion, wasn't investigated enough.
Yes.
So he said that 2 weeks ago, when he was getting off the BART station, the rapid transit station, he was, like, basically walking to his car, which is parked in the parking lot, and a man approached him. Says that this man was about 5'8 to 5'10 and about 35 to 45 years old. And the man said that, and I quote, he had his daughter. That's kind of like it's not a very clear statement. And John, he kind of just thought that he was mentally ill. So he was kind of scared and he walked to his car. The man walked over to the car, like right next to the car, for John to roll down the window. But John just decided to drive off. And basically as he's driving off, He's gotten a little ways. Then he thinks, oh wait, maybe I want to get a better look at him. Maybe I want to see what he looks like in case I talk to the police. So he turns around, goes back to the station, but he can't find the guy anywhere. And so he's kind of freaked out after this. I mean, obviously, as anyone would be. So he decides to go to Jenny's viola lesson. And after he saw that she was safe, he calls Rhoda, his other daughter, and she was safe too. And so he just kind of brushes off this whole thing. He forgot about it. Because he thinks this man's probably crazy. He's probably not related to anything, you know. Because crazy people say crazy stuff all the time. And honestly, I think I would brush this away as well. But I think looking back on it, it's definitely a key part of the puzzle. And so basically, he went to a police sketch artist. And they created a composite, but he wasn't really happy with it. So the family actually hired their own sketch artist to make a composite drawing. And they did this on June the 3rd, which is actually my birthday. And so they're pretty happy with it. You know, they say that he's kind of a lean and gaunt man. Like I said, 5'8 to 5'10, around 35 years old. And so basically, they distributed this sketch to the local media to promote. But unfortunately, nothing came from that. So basically the police in Alameda County, they were kind of, they didn't have enough resources at their disposal to help solve this investigation. It was so flawless. So they call in the FBI. And the first thing they do is take a look at the duct tape that Jenny was bound with. And so actually they matched the tape to the brand, which I kind of was expecting. But, what I thought was pretty cool is that they could figure out like the exact pattern that the killer put the duct tape on. Like, they could find out how it was wrapped, how it was ripped. And apparently, how a person rips duct tape is, like, pretty unique, which is really interesting to me.
Huh.
So there's, like, a pattern to it.
So, like, they can identify... They can, like, identify someone, potentially, from how they wrap duct tape.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty crazy. And this was back in 1994. Obviously, technology's improved so much, so it's just kind of crazy how they figured that. And something crazy also that they did was they came up with a complete profile of the killer. And basically, they said that he was most likely really familiar with the neighborhood. And he may have been there for completely legitimate reasons, like work, or maybe even a neighbor. So said that he was most likely a loner who can interact with others, but definitely prefers his own company as opposed to hanging out in large groups. Say he has a problem with alcohol, which I don't really understand how they figured that one out, but it's like pretty mind-blowing. Like, after the murder, right after the murder, the killer probably left, you know, for a day just to go away, but definitely would have returned. And so, like I said, that this is like a really secluded neighborhood. It's like in the hills. It's just one street of all these like houses that are literally like inches away from each other. And they're, like, nice houses. But there's no suspect, even after, like, weeks of investigation. And so, a little background on the Lins. So, both Lins, both parents, were born in Vietnam. And they went to America for grad school and decided to stay in kids. They chose this neighborhood because they thought it was safe. And they thought that their kids would be happy here, which is just really really unfortunate. So after weeks of investigation, the police, they found their first suspect, and it's a 22-year-old, and they never released his name, so they used the fake name Doug. So he lived in the neighborhood, and initially the police, they never revealed why he was a suspect, but like as the police became, like as they investigated him more, they became more sure that this could definitely be. And so Doug's father, he owned a surgical instrument sharpening business, which is like a really, really odd niche business. But this meant that he had access to potential murder weapons because they weren't able to identify what killed Jenny, like what weapon killed Jenny. So the police called his parents and they said that they were out of town during the murder, but Doug was still in town. And so they talked to Doug, and this is pretty important, but basically apparently he was home all day long, and then he picked up his girlfriend at like 8 and went home with her to hang out, and then they never left the house. So they went and talked to the girlfriend. Like I said, she got off work at 8, which is an hour after the body was found. And police also learned that shortly after the murder, Doug moved in with a friend for like a few weeks and then back to his parents, which is like pretty close to what the FBI said would happen. But unfortunately, there was no evidence or probable cause, so they couldn't arrest him or try him, so they had two other leads. And basically, the next lead is one of the biggest ones they got. So this is August 1994, which is 3 months after the murder. So they got a call from a different police department about a new suspect. So in 600 miles away in Oregon, the police found a man sleeping in a car with a stolen license plate. And the license plate tracks back to Santa Ramona, California, very close to where Jenny lived. And in the book was basically a murder kit. There were books on satanic culture, body chemistry, first aid. There were two ski masks, porn, plastic flex cuffs, which are like basically a plastic handcuffs.
Ooh.
Actual handcuffs, a knife, combat boots, which is like as combat boots on the Markland house, a claw hammer, binoculars, gray duct tape, and a blue bag. And as you may remember, we saw a man leaving with the blue duffel bag that they'd never seen before.
Yeah.
He was identified as 26-year-old Ashton Alexander Shaw. And so basically, when he was arrested, the police immediately thought of Jenny Lynn, and they called the Alameda County Sheriff's Department immediately. And so the first thing that they did was to compare the duct tape with the FBI, like to see if it was a matching role or not. While that was happening, it took a while. They continued to look into Sebastian, and Sebastian worked in California from April to at least May 1994. Which means that he could have been in Alameda County during, like, he would have been in Alameda County during Jenny's murder. But unfortunately, duct tape did not match, which meant that the police had not him. So once again, they couldn't arrest him or try him, so they were back to square one. And so the next step they thought to do was to go back to the neighborhood, and this time they had a questionnaire that was made from the FBI. As opposed to just asking neighbors questions of their own, just stuff like, were you in your neighborhood on May 27th, 1994? What were you doing? Did you see anybody? Did you hear any noise? Stuff like that. That was really helpful. And so, basically, this was also a really big tip that they got from this. So one neighbor who was part of the neighborhood crime watch said that a different neighbor told her that on May 27, 1994, the same day Jenny was murdered, she was watering her garden and she saw a man standing outside of Jenny's house. And shortly after that, she heard glass shattering. And so the police tracked down the woman, but the story that she told police was different. She says she didn't see his face and says that she did not hear any glass break. It's worth noting that in the interview, she was hesitant and kind of uncooperative, and I believe that she was in fear that if she said something, then the man might come back.
Oh my gosh.
And so it's also, so basically they were realizing they were getting nowhere with her. And so they talked to the FBI, and the neighbor, her first language is Arabic. So she may have been fearing some kind of persecution from the police as well. So they brought in an FBI agent who also spoke Arabic to talk to her. And it was just kind of the same story, where she says that she was watering her roses, but then she gives a little more detail, saying the man was short and wearing a dark jacket. And he would walk in front of the Lynn house and then stop walking, then move back and forth. But she says that she never saw him knock on the front door or going around the side, and definitely never heard any glass break. And like I said, they thought that she was afraid of retribution. And basically, they talked to her son, and the son said that the mom, she wasn't wearing her glasses that day, and she had very poor eyesight, which meant that she really couldn't, like, kind of tell what was going on. They told her to let them know if they remembered anything else. They're really stumped right now because they've got no leads, there's no evidence that they can track back to anything else. They decide to revisit Doug in September, which is 5 months after the murder. And so, basically, his story has kind of changed. And so, now he's saying that he was at his job until 6 instead of being home all day. Then he went home to shower, then picked up girlfriend around 8. Honestly, at first I was like, maybe he just forgot or something, but it is kind of suspicious. And so the police went to his employer, and they confirmed that he was not working that day. He just kind of straight up lied to the police. And so, like I said, there's no evidence against Doug except for kind of like a poor story. So they really couldn't do anything, so they kept investigating. And then in February of 1995, police asked him to take a polygraph test. This is really unconventional, but they asked him to rip duct tape. They asked him to compare the patterns between that duct tape and the duct tape of Jenny. They ended up not being similar, and which to me is like kind of an odd request, because it's like if he was the murderer, and I feel like he would know to rip it differently. Like, it's not that hard, so it was kind of a pointless thing, because who would, like, it just doesn't make sense to me. Also, after that, he did refuse to take a polygraph because he was kind of freaked out, and he consulted a lawyer. They had to look into different leads for for a year. And then in February 1996, which is like a year and a half after the murder, they finally gave him a polygraph. He consented to it and searched his car. And so the polygraph, it actually did show that he was lying or showing some kind of deception. But the fibers from his car didn't match any of the fibers on Jenny's body. So once again, they let him go, which is just like, it's kind of crazy to me, because I want to know what he was lying about, like what was going on there. Now, it is worth noting that polygraphs, their accuracy is like 50% of the time, so he could have just been stressed out. I mean, if I was like being interviewed for a murder, I know I'd be stressed out, but still, it's like worth looking into, and I feel like that does like constitute probable cause or something. They had to wait a year again, and so in February 1997, they got a call that there was a law enforcement impersonator among them. And so this man was going around and showing off a badge and basically asking people about the case. And so the police, they finally located a man and they got a warrant to search the car. And in the trunk, they found a roll of duct tape. And it was the same brand as the duct tape that Jenny was murdered with.
Oh my God.
And so as was being analyzed, they discovered that he lived in the same neighborhood as the Lynns with his wife and children. And I should also point out that the house was the same model house as the Lynn's home, so he would have known what it was looked like. This was just flipped. And then also what was crazier is that they found out that he knew Jenny. His daughter went to school with her, and sometimes he would drive both of them in like a carpool situation, so he knew Jenny. And so obviously detectives were like, that raised like a lot of like questions. So they sat him down and interviewed him. And then basically a man was saying that he always has duct tape, that it's not always the same brand. And then he, after being questioned about the Lynn murder, like Jenny's murder, he gets like really mad because he's like, why are you, you're not accusing me of murder? And the police are like, we're not accusing you, but we just want to know what happened. And basically he says that he does remember the night that Jenny was murdered. It was like, cause like something like that, after living in a safe community like that, obviously something that's gonna like stick out to you, you know what I mean? And so he takes a computer voice stress test. Basically the computer like listens to his voice and it can tell if he's lying or not. to answer a few questions. Like, you guess, passes a test. But once again, these tests are called into question with, like, again, like a 50% accuracy rate. So who knows?
Yeah.
And so basically, the FBI has been analyzing this duct tape this whole time to see any it's the same role. And so it's not the same role, but as I said, it's the same pattern. But the tear pattern was similar. It had a lot of similarities to the crime scene tear, which is really, to the police, it was a really big red flag. So they get fibers from his car and they send it to the FBI. But they also find that he has a reserve deputy badge, which basically just means it's like, if the police ever need more hand, they call upon him. Kind of like a draft, I guess. And he actually was a former reserve deputy. And the fibers that they gathered weren't conclusive anything. So once again, they are forced to let him go.
Hmm.
And they don't get anything until 1998, when Sebastian Shaw, who was the man that was living in the car with the murder kit, he was arrested in Oregon for sexually assaulting a woman at gunpoint. So police, they take his DNA, and they put it in a system, and it matches a sexual assault test from 18-year-old Donna Ferguson. And this is also, it's a sexual assault, but it's a murder of Donna and her boyfriend, Tommy Rudiger. Basically, they were living in the trailer park, and someone broke in and stabbed them to death, and then bound their hands behind their cord, which is kind of like the same MO as Jenny's murder. And it also connected Sebastian to the 1991 murder of Jay Rickbeel, who once again had been bound with cords. Investigators took a closer look at him because, like I said, he was in the area at the time for work, as we mentioned before, but he denied any involvement. And so they used DNA testing for him, like on his car and stuff, but Jenny's DNA was not found. And so really nothing came of that. Like, obviously Shaw was in prison now for like 3 life sentences for murder. And then in 2005, which is 11 years after Jenny's murder, nothing's really happened. They get a call from the cellmate of Shaw, claimed that Shaw told him that he had murdered 13 people, which is like, he's a serial killer. He was bragging about it. Oh. Which to me, that was kind of where, like, this dude did it. You know what I mean? Like, he's got the same MO. He's killed 13 people in the area at the time of Jenny's death. Like, however, one thing that is confusing to me is that I looked him up.
Yeah.
And he's a heavy set man. He's not itty bitty. Mm-hmm. And essentially the hole in the window is tiny. Like I said, I was surprised that anybody could get through that. And so what does confuse me is, unless he gained a bunch of weight, because the photo was much later, which is a potential option, I don't see how he could get through that tiny hole in the window. But back to, like, his cellmate. So his cellmate told police that Shaw told him that he had killed 30 people. Basically what he does is he likes to bind his victims, sexually assault them, kill their cars, and likes to switch license plates so, like, the police can't catch him. And then he stabs victims, just like Jenny, and uses the knife to cut off victims' clothes, just like Jenny. So the detectives, they get a swab of DNA from him, and Sebastian tells them that he's killed at least 10 people, which is lower than that cellmate. And they continue to interview him, but he denies murdering somebody in that area. He is publicly identified as the suspect in the case, which is like the first suspect that they've had this whole time. Like, and so they asked him if he can be formally questioned, which he consents to. But right as they get to prison, he says, psych, you can't actually. And so basically what my mindset is that he was going to confess to the murder, I think. That's my opinion. But then he kind of realized that, you know, killing is a really bad rap in prison. Like, if you remember Jeffrey Dahmer, he got murdered because everyone was like, this dude's a weirdo. It's kind of that same principle of, like, in prison, like, there are some things that are, like, condemned. Like, and, like, killing a 14-year-old girl, that's definitely going to be one of them. So maybe he was afraid. After that, Jenny's dad had kind of convinced himself that Shaw was the murderer. And so he wrote a letter to Shaw, basically saying, you know, it's been 11 years and I've not been able to move on. I know you did the murder, so please be responsible for it. And basically Shaw writes back and says, you know, I've gotten a ton of letters from tons of journalists. I don't know if you're actually Jenny Lynn's father, but if you will meet face to face, I'll talk to you. As well as, like, you leave your phone number for me. Jenny-Lynn's father basically was saying, like, you know, I can't do that. I cannot meet you face to face. Like, it's too much for me. I just want you to admit what you've done. Basically, Shaw was, like, straight up just like, dude, I don't know if you're really who you say you are, and I can't trust the letter. And then he also said something interesting to me. He says that Jenny's murder was organized. Shaw's crimes were, like, spurred the moment, like the passion of it. He doesn't always do the same thing. Keep in mind that the police haven't really reported on, like, how anything has happened. Like, they're kind of, like, they haven't really reported on the murder. So how would Shaw know that it was organized? And has he been doing research into it? It doesn't make sense. Mr. Lin, he writes a letter back, and he continues to, he basically just, like, I know you did it. You are an organized man. That's how you got away with so much. And that was the final letter between them. And for the next 7 years, nothing happened in the case. Basically, police kind of hit a stalemate. Like, the crime was so flawlessly committed, they just didn't know what was going. They didn't know what was happening. Nothing really happened until 2015. He was once again questioned for the murder, but then denied involvement. And he died in 2021, so he's dead now. He was 53. And the prison won't say why he died. There wasn't a cause listed. So that was kind of like the end of the only really good lead police had had for, you know, years, decades even. The investigation is ongoing, and there is foreign DNA they found at the scene that they couldn't identify. And the police are very hopeful that it will be solved. But, you know, I'm not really sure, to be honest, that it will. Because, like I said, in my opinion, Shaw did the murder. Like, he had murdered people in similar styles before. You know, this kind of... I'm wondering if he didn't... If the sexual assault test that they did on Jenny either wasn't accurate, perhaps he never got time to because Jenny's dad got home. Because usually he sexually assaults them, but he didn't do that with Jenny. But at the same time, I am convinced that it was Shaw. And I'm just sad for the parents because they're not able to get kind of that confirmation, that literal confession from Shaw that they deserve. But maybe the killer's still out there. Like I said, the police, the case hasn't, it's not a cold case. They're still looking into it. They just haven't had any substantial lead in many years. But like I said, they have DNA, FBI is still helping them with this. You know, there's like a $200,000 reward on whoever did this, or in tips that could help solve it. So, you know, hopefully they find it out, but it's just terrifying.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the cookies done yet?
They are. You know what? I think I burnt them.
No.
Yeah.
How long did you put them in for?
I put them in for 13 minutes, but I think I cut them differently than how they wanted them to be cut in the recipe. So some of them are very burnt. I can salvage, like, some of them, though.
Now you know, folks. Whatever. Even if it's burnt, I'm sure it's still gonna taste great, you know? Who doesn't mind a little crunch?
Thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story, and I hope we enjoy the cookies. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.